Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and I'm left of center.
And I'm Rich, and I tend to lean a little bit more to the right. But the bottom line is together we try to look for the balance of what it means to be human in today's world.
So let's get started. Welcome to Living in the Matrix, everyone. I'm Jonathan. This is my co-host, Rich. Say hello, Rich.
What's shaking, everybody? Happy Friday. It is a gorgeous day out there.
It is. And this episode is... we're going to cover a bunch of topics. We had a total blast doing this last time and, about a month ago, and yeah. Rich and I talked about it and we didn't have a guest today. So we thought, let's go back to that because it really sparked some really interesting conversation. And I know you and I were talking a little bit before we started, but what topic do you want to start with this week?
Well, one of the things that has been blowing my mind recently is a move to Christianity, if not Catholicism, that I've been seeing, not only, with some celebrities, but even something more specific, right? So here's the first thing. Let's talk about what is going on with this kind of shift recently to either Christianity or Catholicism. It seems to be pretty strong. Okay. Catholic people coming to home. Yeah.
What gives you that sense?
Well, it's big names like Candace Owens. There was a porn star recently came to Catholicism. And then I was listening to a podcast, Justin Brierley, who had a gal by the name of Leah Labresco. And she was in an atheist club, but she found some smart Catholic folks at Yale. Mm-hmm. And then she became a Catholic. And then more recently, I've been following Russell Brand. And he did the rosary, he celebrated Lent, and I just found out today that he's getting baptized on Sunday. So that's kind of crazy. And I've got some reasons why they're making these moves, right? And so that's the other thing I'd like to unpack is not only what's going on, but why and why now. So that's the first one.
And I want to add to that list, I don't want to say Joe Rogan is a Christian. But he's been talking a lot like he's not found Christianity. He's sort of like discovered this cool cat named Jesus, and he's actually interesting. And I think it's captured his imagination. So I want to add that to the list. I'm not saying he's a Christian, but he is talking a shit ton about Jesus. So
He talked about Jesus coming back, right? Like, Jesus, we need you or something, right? If you're out there, like, those are the kinds of things where –
he threw it out there on his podcast all the time now, and how Jesus just made sense. He's really been gone. So what is your points that you wanted to make about it? So let's assume for argument's sake that there is a movement towards Christianity.
Yeah. But I mean, it seems like some celebrity, there's some celebrities and big names that are happening recently, right? And I'm going to find out what's going on. And what's interesting is it's kind of a it might be a different push against what Nate was describing when he was on, where he was seeing, you know, small communities focused on health and diet and exercise and sharing best practices kind of can be this movement. As people, there are a lot of people moving away from Christianity. We've seen a lot of that happen over the last 5-10 years too. It seems like people are abandoning mainline Christianity, you know, other evangelicals. But I think over the last 2 to 3 years, things are shifting back, right? And so there's a problem. I think there's a good reason for that, Jonathan.
What do you think the reason is?
Well,
because here's what I can believe. I don't know. The numbers suggest that we're moving towards none rather than Christianity. So this last year was the first year the nuns outpaced evangelical Christianity, first time ever. So the trend is towards none. But to your point, there are some really high profile people turning towards Christianity. And I think that is where we can at least talk about. And I can totally agree. I see it. Especially the one about Joe Rogan. That's the one that captured my imagination. Oh, yeah. He speaks to millions of people every day.
So yeah.
It's just truly interesting. So what's your thought behind it?
Well, there's a few thoughts, right? The first one, this is what Russell Brand said why he's getting baptized. He says, as meaning deteriorates, he found that Jesus always beckons, right? So one of the things that we're seeing out there in this trend, I mean, we're seeing postmodernism going beyond itself and almost imploding, right? When you've got two people you know, having completely different ideas, all completely convicted about something. When you're seeing a lot of science getting debunked now, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the science, trust the science on the vaccine was, you know, 6 feet away from each other. That's the safe space. Mm-hmm. And then they look back and they said, oh shit, we just made that up. You've got Fauci saying the science says that this coronavirus was somehow a bat, you know, mated with a pergolin at a wet market in China. And that's when it started. And then, of course, we're realizing now that, no, it's an actual gain of function. You know, it was an actual coronavirus laboratory. So people are looking and they're not seeing things getting better. They're seeing things get worse, and we've been relying on science and all these things. And they're saying, you know what? Maybe this religion thing isn't so bad. Maybe this belief in a God isn't so far-fetched, because I'm seeing stuff every day that makes me question my own reality. And if I've got something, if I know, let's talk about the Catholic Church. If there's something that's been around for 2,025 years, whatever it's been around after Jesus died, the Catholic Church has been there. Come hell or high water, right? We know the Catholic Church has not been really, really amazing lately with all the abuse and the scandals and the systematic, you know, shifting around of people. But mm-hmm. at the same time, they're saying, but there is so much tradition. And think of the greatest minds like Aquinas, like Augustine, right? Like all these mm-hmm. others. And so I think that's one of the reasons why they might be moving more towards a Catholic standpoint. The Catholics also tend to be intellectuals, right? If you think of G.K. Chesterton, if you think about like Aquinas and some of the greatest names, they had a very intellectual mind. And even C.S. Lewis. So we used to go to Campus by the Sea, this camp in Catalina Island every summer. And there was a guy who was a speaker there, and he studied C.S. Lewis his whole life. And he was convinced that if C.S. Lewis had lived a little bit longer, he would have become converted to Catholicism. He was a high Anglican, and obviously his best friend was J.R. Tolkien, right? They wrote the Narnia series and Lord of the Rings together. What I'm getting at is that, you know, they've got a good way of looking at it intellectually. And this gal, Leah Labresco, Jonathan, who was on Unbelievable podcast, she made an intellectual ascent. She didn't have this kind of, you know, altar call where you and I, we talk about getting emotions, we feel that movement of the spirit. She did it from an intellectual. She did feel exhilarated when she made the move. But at the same time, she's a mathematician, and she looked at the laws of what morality might look like. And her atheist friend, who's also a very cool dude, I mean, his name is, he's called the Friendly Atheist on podcasts and stuff. He didn't have a good reason other than it makes the most sense. Like somebody said, "What is it wrong to classify some people as better than others? Like, everybody should be created equal, right? It doesn't matter if you're a man or woman." Yet he goes, "No, I agree." "Well, where do you get that?" "Well, doesn't everybody feel that way?" And she goes, "No, what about the Taliban? The Taliban sure as hell don't believe that we're all equal. The Taliban treat their women like animals, like chattel, right?" And unfortunately, this has happened over the years. And his response was, "Well, duh, I totally believe it's the right thing to do." And she goes, "Where do you get that?" And those are the kinds of things that she said. She said, God gives a better rational argument for the case of morality than non-God, non-theism. Even Roger Dawkins, this is hilarious. Dawkins literally admitted about a month or two ago that he's a cultural Christian. So even though he would still reject all of the miracles and the divinity and the things like that, he goes, "I love singing a carol. Or a hymn. I'll be in the shower and I'll start singing a Christian hymn." It's because he loves what that brought. He had a good childhood, he had a good family life, and he liked that background. He calls himself a cultural Christian, you know, because we're English. And the reason why I think it's also important is because he's been very critical of Islam, right? And he and Richard or Sam Harris, these guys, and even Christopher Hitchens. One of the things that the four horsemen of the apocalypse, I don't know about Daniel Dennett, but Hitchens, Dawkins and Harris were all vitriolic towards Islam and the pain and the suffering and the terrorism and the lives they'll kill in the sake of their religion, right? So that's one thing that they were united by, which is interesting. Anyway,
so how does this tie back to people like celebrities becoming Christian or Catholic?
Here's what Candace Owens said. And by the way, Candace Owens' husband is a Catholic. He recently became Catholic, but she said recently made the decision to go home. There is, of course, so much more that went into this discussion.
Was she an atheist before?
I don't know. She was probably just a libertarian. Okay. She was. She seemed to be more of a secularist, right? Okay. She probably had a belief in of sorts, but I'm not sure the full story. But she goes, there is, of course, so much more that went into this decision, and that I plan to share in the future. But for now, praise be to God for his gentle but relentless guiding of my heart mm-hmm. toward truth. And Russell Brand said something similar. Remember what he said? He said, Jesus always beckons, right? So you've got two celebrities who are very famous. I mean, both very public and vocal, who now are seeing, you know, the world a little bit more crazy, more tenuous, and I think they're trying to find something that might have some more stability for them. Maybe that's what it comes down to. It's a sense of security and stability and something that at least millions can believe in, if not the fact that the church has been around for 2,000 years, right?
Yeah, and I think part of like I'll use Joe's example.
Yeah.
Joe, and this is one of the things that I've learned on this podcast, is by interviewing a large segment of different people from us, because that's really what we've done, mm-hmm. you start seeing the beauty and difference and value of it, because we've talked to people about the positive elements of it. And I think Joe is now on his like 1,000th show. I mean, that and he interviews yeah. people at the top of the bestseller list. That's his primary person that he interviews, is he does a lot of books, and he's interviewing people with a deep breadth of information about a very specific topic, and he's learning it all with him. Mm-hmm. Like that's, you can't go through that and not ask the deeper questions about, is there a God or isn't there a God? And I think there's a lot of good evidence that there is a God. But I always want to find a space to respect the atheist. But I think people are beginning to realize, man, the part of social media, one of the values of it is that it calls bullshit really fast now.
Yeah.
And I think the world is beginning to say, what the fuck, people? We need to start dealing with our own bullshit, because we're now totally broke and we're pretending mm-hmm. we're not in an inflationary depression. You know, it's like there's a lot of shit going on right now, and we're kind of asking, God, where are you? You know,
yeah.
It's like, when does God explode? During war, because that's when people need God the most.
Yeah, and terrible times, a very adversarial kinds of times, and maybe that creates a place in us. Interestingly enough, that you know, you think meditation and prayer and cortisol don't really go hand in hand very well. And yet at the same time, if we truly believe in the divine, Jonathan, this cosmic force of good, the source wants to bring balance to this, he or she will interject and help that come along better, right? Because again, we can still go back to Neo. Neo had a splinter in his mind. It was driving him crazy. But it was something drawing him, right? Something drawing him, right? And that was external to him. That was not him. That was external to him. Now, again, we live in this dichotomy where, you know, we are the one, but actually we are also different. We're an avatar, if you would. But we have to go through these kinds of perspectives. And I think going back to what you were saying about theism versus non-theism, one of the things that would be really exciting is if our levels of consciousness were so transcendent that even as an atheist, you see the vibrations in science that reflect what we are in pure scientific terms. And yeah. the theist says, no, this is all God. God created these constructs. Let's all get together, break bread, and join our humanity together to change things for the better. And so now you've got this alignment where there is no dichotomy. It's like unified field, mm-hmm. pure spirit. Is it the Atman? Is it Brahma? Is it God? It's yes. Yes, it is. How do you break things down though? Because this is where people aren't transcending, right? Claiborne talks about some of us are ready and more ready and others are not. And over the course of eons and eons and eons of time, the hand, the source will reach down for that person who's rejected time and time again, right? We kind of hearkened that in episode 2, it is like almost a universalistic theme, but at the same time, it's like, no, we're going to just reconcile things. Cause that ultimately seems like needs to be harmonized.
Let me give you a perspective on your first idea that I had as I was reflecting on it. Cause you talked about, we are sort of at the end of the postmodern experiment. And I think to a certain extent that's true, but it was also extremely valuable. Cause here's what I think is, as human beings, historically, for pretty much from, probably maybe 300 or 400 years, you know, like 1600s and back, there's sort of a dominant world or tribal thought. You know, a lot of tribes, but there's, you know, the matrix was the empires, the way people thought, who controlled that thought. And so historically, what Jesus did is sort of, or any tribe, is give them a way of identifying that is unifying. And so there's this, Christianity has always said, Jesus is the one idea, be like that. And mm-hmm. So there was this single image that it was almost impossible to, for everybody to fit in, because it's hard to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
Postmodernism came along and said, no, okay, let's all be individuals. But to do that, you have to let go of a lot of tradition of there's one way of doing things, because grace says, no, there is the individual. And I think what's happened is we've gotten here and realized, okay, this is valuable. This freedom we're experiencing here is very valuable. But I miss the tradition part.
Of course, yes.
And I think that's what people are asking, because like I've said, social media spins up your learning cycles. That's mm-hmm. what it does, is it teaches you very fast how to cycle through ideas. And it's changing. I think we're coming to the end of the postmodern experiment. I don't know if it's the end, because there's always going to be the need for the individual, but there's also this burgeoning need for tradition. I was talking to some friends in a Facebook group I'm in about deconstruction from Christianity, and you can't let go. I want to ask an atheist, if you were to take mushrooms and experience that sense of oneness that is almost a universal sense of what people on psychedelics experience, would you call that God?
No, they wouldn't, though, according to Brittany.
So then I would ask, okay, let's take it to – that's the religious –
they would call it cosmic love. They felt something transcendent, sure. Something sure, other, something right. That they couldn't explain.
Okay, but on the scientific side, you've got the unified field, which is this representative of the nothingness,
mm-hmm.
and where it's all one. Okay. And what would you call that? And I think those are one in the
same.
That's
what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. And I think this is purely scientific. This is purely religious. And the head and the heart are now coming together where people are waking up. And I think that's when you create coherence, it blows away the bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
That's what coherence does. It removes the bullshit. And I think people are waking up to, okay, it's going to be a hard experiment. Because think about it. Imagine if a large group of people started dramatically find a way for everyone to get out of poverty. Like, we solve that mm-hmm. problem. You know, that's the idea of this unified field, or this sense of God, the kingdom, is what does that look like? Like, you and I only have this life. Why not try those ideas? Because we don't try those ideas. And I think it's happening. And that's what I think people are drawn towards. The celebrities, they just happen to be the ones. Because there's a void being created that needs to be filled.
So you brought up a very interesting point for me just now, because it's about the unified field. So when people talk about it, when they use non-pharmaceutical, non-psychotropic methods, it's through meditation. And everybody right. knows that when you meditate, you spend a lot of time dicking around, thinking with your thoughts, getting distracted. And then you spend a key set of moments in there just really transcending. And that's what, David Lynch calls the unified field. That's what we all call that. That's what and there's a feeling that I get when I meditate, when I'm in that zone. It's kind of very pleasurable. I feels like it could be by the pineal gland as well. But what I'm getting at is you can't live there. It's a touch of something that you really enjoy. And you could call that a slice of heaven. But the problem is that you can't have unity in that. So the reason why people do meditation is because what they do is when they tap into that just for a little bit, when they exit that process and they go out into the world, they're becoming more and more like that unified field, and it just exudes, and you get and you create love. You can see a conflict, and you can help bring that down just with energies. All these things, right? This is why people do this, and yet, so what I'm saying is that experience of heaven that Christians call oneness and love and you know adoration for our Creator and being tapped into the source. Is that the same thing as being in the unified field that whole time? It seems like it could be. The question I'm saying to you is, how can you make the unified field something permanent? And also, I mean, see, poverty wouldn't exist in the unified field. Isn't that correct? Because the unified field is not an actual living place. It's a state. It's an absolute plane.
So I'll share with you what I think is, this is my, the thing is, psychedelics consistently produce the same experience of oneness. It's a sense of consistent belonging that is sustained. It's not temperamental. It stays. You feel it over an extended period of time. And that feeling of oneness is the same feeling people at church at worship have. It's like are those the same? Well, here's the fact. They produce the same chemical response. That's what's intriguing about it. Yeah. Is this idea of the chemical response is the outcome of the thought. And that tells me there's something valuable there, especially when it compels people to love their neighbor. That's like, look at the 60s. The 60s were all about peace and love.
Yeah,
and then it got squashed. And how they did that is they, I think they took away the, they bribed the boomers with a lot of money. That's how you control people, is through money. And so they,
how do you bribe them in en masse like that? In what capacity?
You create wealth. You create the capacity for wealth. And that's what the Silicon Valley boom was about. All right. I want to shift to another topic.
Okay.
And I liked this one. This one was the Christian one. I really like that one because it's I think something is shifting in culture. And I think we're seeing it in a much more dramatic scale this year. So, so my next idea is I was walking my dog the other night, and I had this thought that people are always trying to understand woke. To be awake is very different than woke. Woke is a very political idea now.
Yes.
Its roots were in slavery, by the way, but they were co-opted by a group of people who have essentially demonized white men as a category. I think that's the core of woke. Okay. And because they're pissed off, it's a sense of righteous judgment. But the irony of it, like, there's a lot of things that white men have done, but the irony of it is it's really one of the categories where white men go, well, that's fucked up. And the irony of it is then, well, why don't you recognize it in when you do that to us? That's, I think, one of the dialogues of woke, is it's a group of people who have demonized white men because, and I'm part of this group, we are part of a group of people that has historically been in power with the money to enact central structures that have caused horrific damage. Now we've also done great things, but it's, I think that's the tension that is happening. And I think, cause I'm on both sides of this. I want reconciliation. I think woke is by its very nature, by demonizing it, cripples itself to actually solve any problems, because you can't reconcile or solve a problem when you're killing the person you're trying to communicate with. That's why it won't work. It needs something more like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to say, listen, if you come forward, we will give you grace. And if we enact a sense of grace about it, like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission did, we can, everybody can move forward without a sense of killing each other. So what do you think?
Well, you know, the thing about woke is that on a conservative level, it's often seen as a definite pejorative, right? It's not a good thing. It's on its face value, woke sounds like awake, sounds like alert, sounds like they know what's going on.
Right.
But I want to differ a little bit with you in terms of what, where you're defining woke as anti, you know, white men, because I mean, woke can be so many different things.
I don't think that's exclusive, but I think that's the dominant narrative.
Yeah.
It's like, the easy target because it's there.
Yeah. So what I'm saying though is like, there's Greta Thunberg, you know, how dare you at the United Nations meeting, and all of the people that are, you know, extra, you know, voracious to try to tap into that. That would be considered woke from most Republicans, right? Most conservatives would say, oh, let's get on the Greta Thunberg bus. Also applies to, can men get pregnant, right? You know, like biological men get pregnant. Well, they're, you know, et cetera. And if you espouse the idea that men can get pregnant, then that's considered woke. So there's just a couple of those issues. I do agree also, though, when in terms of, it's what's really sad, though. So for instance, you know, we should all want to have marched in solidarity with Martin Luther King, right? You know, in Selma, et cetera. But there's a difference between that and, let's say, Black Lives Matter, where we found that most millions of dollars were stolen from multiple people in this regard, that it's, it tends to be more political than actual about real race. And it seems to be more antagonistic and not trying to create real dialogue. But when you start to go down those paths, that's where it's unfortunate. I think what's sad is a lot of the people on the right just use woke as a blank slate to say, okay, this person, this person is a drag queen waving a flag for Palestine, and the irony, of course, is that that drag queen would get their ass kicked in Gaza, because in Islam you can't do that stuff, right? You're done. Right. You can get killed in certain parts of the world with Islam as the religion if you're caught in those kinds of acts. So people look at that and they go, that's woke. And so I don't know what category you put that in, but what's really sad about it all is that we're still, by having those kinds of definitions of white nationalism, white Christian nationalism, and, you know, like white nationalists for Trump versus obviously, you know, woke versus based, what you end up getting is you get to not do any research. You get to just call names and you get to show up not really knowing what you're doing and why you're trying, if you're trying to solve a solution, right? Whereas if people came to the table on both sides, right? Not just the right calling the woke left, the left woke, and not just, you know, them calling them, you know, crackers or whatever, come together with a way to solve these problems in dialogue and good debate. Because there are great debates on both sides, right?
Well, I think that's the problem, is that people think debates are won by demonizing the other side, and that doesn't work.
That's exactly right.
It creates the chaos and animosity that makes it a really fabulous event on TV. But I think what's being exhausted is this point of the media's version of what we should be, which is always at war, you know, always in conflict. Like, that's what sells. But the reality
is
becoming exhausting. Living like
it
that,
is,
you know,
it is.
For 40 years now, we've sort of lived under greed is good capitalism. Okay. And I think that has, like, what greed has shown is that it sucks. That's all that's happened is that we've proven greed doesn't create a better society.
This
greed wasn't good, and now we're reaching a point where it's like, what next? And I think that's the unified field. And I think hopefully we are at a point where women are brought to the table in equal or even more numbers, because when we talk about really needing new ideas, true reconciliation is going to require the feminine compassionate.
Yeah.
With the masculine responsible. It's they both have to come together, and we got to figure out a way to I don't want my grandkids growing up in a world where everyone's at odds. You know, it's like that's the thing that I love about AI is within 5 years, virtually every human being in the world is going to have access to AI. It's going to dramatically increase learning. And can we get over some of these basic problems that are so obvious that peace just works better?
It just does.
You know,
you're bringing something important up, because I was just thinking about this dichotomy of people and the idea that, I just lost my train of thought. I took a gummy before this, so
you did.
It always throw me off there a little bit. But I was coming back to the idea of, you were just saying something about, it was going to be about unity and the ability to break down like these kind of barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it's going to take.
Do you think it's possible?
It's going to stop with name calling. I know exactly where I'm going with this. The problem is we've been in so much pain recently, and now we're in financial pain, right? I think COVID was just emotional pain, spiritual pain. Now everybody's really getting financial pain. I just looked at this, two chicken breasts we cooked up two nights ago. It was $14, dude, for organic chicken breasts. Two chicken breasts, $14.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we're also seeing these people show up on campus. They not only do they
new thought is created.
Yeah, but one of these gals was asked, what are you doing? Tell us about how NYU is standing for Gaza. She goes, I don't really know what we're doing here. We're just kind of showing up. And then her friend was like, yeah, I'm so uneducated. They didn't even know. They couldn't even articulate why they were there at this massive rally. And what that is it's a spiritual en masse. It's like, I want to just shout and scream and show up and be unified with some people. And I just want to feel that energy, right? And this is where I think everything,
waves are so powerful.
Oh my gosh, 100%. And I think that's where we're going, dude. We're seeing a cosmic shift of collective humanity, of a groan, of a shove, of a heave. I need something. Is got to give. Something is got to give. And I don't know if the universe or the divine uses all of that kind of energy in one kind of frame. You know, like, I don't know if you remember like in Monsters, Inc., when you scared the kid, you got a lot of energy, and all these monsters had to scare all the kids, so they produce all the energy, right? Well, at the end, laughter blew it out of the charts, right? So, right, remember when she giggled at the end, and all of a sudden the meter went super high up? I don't know if you remember this. Mm-hmm. But what I'm getting at is that, you know, if people are actually – getting people out of poverty. If we took away, let's say that everybody was hit with a terrible tragedy, but they were still well off. They would deal with that tragedy. They would have emotional, spiritual, even possible physical pain, and then they would move on. But then life goes on, right? I believe if you could pull us out of poverty, Jonathan, and we got to a level where we had actually money to spend, we wouldn't spend so much time screaming and shouting. We would just deal with the other things on the side, right? So the thing about where we are in, I think, a really tough financial situation is that's affecting people, because that's, you know, going down to Dawkins' level, right? When he talks about in transcending levels of consciousness, like, ask yourself, what's the worst thing that could happen to you if you lose your job, and keep asking, and then what, and then what, and then what, and then you would die, basically because you couldn't live on food anymore. Everything comes down to because you're afraid of death. Mm-hmm. So what I'm getting at is how do we help get to a levels of iterations so that these conversations have become better, right? As you said, calling something woke or calling something this is just a lazy way out. But there have to be this progressive levels of understanding, right?
That's what I was trying to draw out is
yeah.
Woke is a demonization of a group of people in response to oppression.
Okay? Yes.
The core essence of woke is intentionally good, that they're trying to fight for people's dignity.
Yes.
But the way they're doing it is to take away the dignity of a group of people and say, see how this feels. That doesn't work. It never works to take away the dignity of your oppressor. That's what Paulo Freire knew, is you can't overcome your oppressor by killing him. The only way you create a unified field or a unified people is to redeem. And that's what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission
yes.
did, is they found a way that didn't require you to kill or imprison the people that harmed you. What was really important is a sense of forgiveness and verbalization that this did happen. Because what a lot of people trying to get over is just a need to be, have my truth heard.
Yeah.
And I think, are we at a point in history where we have AI at our disposal to craft something new that is in that is different?
Yeah.
That's the question.
Yeah. The only sad thing about the TRC is that it lasted about a generation and a half and now it's done, right? So it seems like they're back. There's a lot more pain and suffering going on down there, including a lot of the Africans themselves, like, causing a lot of violence. But
let me ask you the question again.
Yeah.
Do you think a unified field is possible in our lifetime?
Not unless you die. I don't know. I
well, you don't think it's possible in this life?
I don't understand what it would actually be like to be in a unified field for eternity. Because it would blow my mind, I think. Maybe that's a different level. I mean, because you talk about being in the unified field when you're on psilocybin, for instance, right? And you think mm-hmm. that's touching it. But again, you're also having full faculties. While you're in that place, you're still breathing, living, you know, you're almost living in two worlds, right? The unified mm-hmm. field is not, you do not notice anything else. You are just there and there's nothing going on. That's why it's so magic in terms
it's
of
what it's what my friend Brett said is it's just an intense sense of peace.
It is.
You don't have to prove anything. You don't have to be more or do more or get more to be accepted. You're already accepted. It's like sitting in the midst of your very best friends in your entire life. And they're all telling you how much they love you. That's what it feels like.
Well, I would say that in many ways, it's almost like there is no feeling sometimes, right? You have no awareness of other, right?
A good way of putting it is there is no other.
Yeah, there's no awareness of other or of anything if you get to that right place.
And I think,
yeah.
So here's the thing. The sense of oneness that we're experiencing in the unified field is energy, is purest form. And that is what I think Jesus meant when he said, I am. He says, I'm part of that. I am. I'm always present. So that energy can never be exhausted, according to the first law of thermodynamics, but it can transmute into something different, the second law of thermodynamics.
Law of conservation of energy,
of course.
And I think
that is, the more people are aware of the value of that experience, the more we can hopefully recreate it, because it is naturally therapeutic.
Yes.
To the feeling of oneness and connectedness and belonging is what church used to be.
Well, when your pulse gets down to 48 beats per minute, when you're in the middle of that, sometimes you can see it on your health app. That's a great place to be. That is the body and the mind and everything tapping into the energy of the source, right? I just, you know, for me, I just need to get better at it because I need more of that. You know, it feels like I need to be in it more often, right? And I need it to last longer. So there's this point where when you've been doing this long enough, you know, you dive right into it right away. You don't spend 10, 15 minutes, you know.
Yeah, you can get there right away.
Yeah. Although Byron Yates, who has been doing meditation for 8 years, he does the Vedic style. We remember him from, both had a friend who shot himself and he had a 30-year marriage that went south, but has had the like two best blissful years of his life. And he even says that I think the reason they make it 20 minutes each time is because that first 10 to 15 is like just your mind going elsewhere, right? And so, but what I'm getting at is how this is what's so powerful about the unified field is if you do 10 minutes of that in the morning and 10 and you're in the pure unified field and you do that every day for 20 years, that's just going to have this massive vibrational effect on your outward appearance and who you interact with and stuff like that.
And I think you can be extremely intentional about that connectedness. Because what I do is when I walk my dog, I'm extremely intentional to go right into that space and live there. And I try and live that consciousness all the way into going to sleep. And
what is that intentionality? Tell me, describe to me exactly what that looks like.
It's an intention of, here's what the unified field feels like to me. Okay. It's a sense of I am good. Like anything that I could that could possibly give me fear has to first pass through that rule. And what comes out of this is just love. That's all it is. So everything that I filter has to go through good. And so I've kind of consciously gotten over, am I good? I know that I'm good, not because that's the nature of source that I am part of. So I don't have to prove it anymore. It's like that allowed me to then connect to how do I was having a conversation around it. 20 years ago, I read How to Win Friends and Influence People, which basically was the idea, and phenomenal book. It's probably one of the best books I've ever read. He said, if you want friends, become a friend and you'll always have friends. That's basically the tenet. And what I realized is, holy shit, it worked. Right. Like it really worked because I have spent a lot of the last 10 years of my life really learning how to invest in people first. And that's love. And I realized, oh, I can love. And that has made my life infinitely better because my relationships are a lot more rewarding. And I'm much more creative and ambitious because I'm not dealing with a lot of the bullshit that was really characterized the first probably 35 years of my life.
Yeah. So. That's amazing, man.
So it's I think people are waking up wanting they want the science and the religion to match.
Yes.
And I think that may be what's happening right now in this age that is the age of Aquarius is where the heart and the mind, because this is science, this is religion, and these two are coming together.
Yes.
And I think so. I'm reading, I'll close and then we'll switch to the next topic. I'm reading this book and it's probably, I want the readers to know this. It's How Emotions Are Made by Dr. Lisa Barrett. I want to highly recommend this book. Absolutely phenomenal. And in it, she's basically saying, we are at a point in history where the head, we're realizing we've almost cut off the body from the head. We say, oh, when something happens, a disease in the body, it's biology, it's physiology, it's not mental. Right. And she's saying neuroscience is now basically destroying that notion.
Okay? Wow.
Completely destroying it, that all disease is created by mental.
Wow. Wow.
100%. But And as we break down there, as we break down those barriers, that allows us to make the connections of the head and the heart. And that's what's happening at a scientific level. I think what the
is this gal even saying, if you had somebody with bubonic plague literally spit on you or cough blood on you and you were exposed to that, that you wouldn't die because it's in your head? Or are you saying like 99%? You know what I'm saying? Like there are I mean, if you're in a, let's say you're being sprayed with pesticides. No,
here's how it works. How it works. Okay. The brain only operates on prediction. Okay. It only operates on prediction. You don't ever choose to do something. You operate on, this is what life has taught me is the best option predicted at this moment. Okay.
Okay.
And anything we learn basically before nine is mostly our genetics influencing those paths. But everything is 100% chosen, okay, or constructed in our head, because there's the external and then there's the internal. And the your body, that prediction then sees in an external environment, it sees that message, it feels the feeling, and then it comes up and it creates an assessment of it. It's a constructed assessment that your body follows. Whatever you construct, that's what your body will follow. And the problem is that pain is also a prediction. So you have an experience of, oh, your arm gets cut. And the first time you experience it, you go, oh, that's what getting cut in your arm feels like. And so the neck or a shot that she uses the idea of a shot. She goes, children
getting
will
jabbed, get a shot. Like getting a vaccine. Yeah.
And then the next time they come to the doctors, they're literally shaking.
Pavlov. Yeah, right. Totally.
And it's because what's happening is the prediction mechanism in your brain is setting off. Now here's the reality. If you hook up EKG and an MRI to it, you can see that they're having the exact same chemical response as getting cut.
Yes.
And here's the thing is the brain can actually construct a false narrative. It can neuroscience is teaching us that the brain can construct an illusion and live by it.
Yeah. Well, Anna and Joe Dispenza's book, right? At the beginning, her husband.
Everything Joe talks about is completely validated by what she says. Everything.
Yep. Yep.
And so we're at this period of time where science, the head, is beginning to talk to religion, the heart, and go, hey, we need each other. Because there's value in traditions. We just have to get rid of all the bullshit part of it.
Right.
So one of the things that we talked about last episode with Brian was a sense of powerlessness. Okay. We're going into an election year with probably people are potentially expecting it to be even more crazy than the last one. Mm-hmm. People are kind of freaking out going, I'm trying not to worry about it, but it's probably in the back of everybody's mind. And what do people, or do you feel powerless to stop what's happening in Washington?
Yes. One of the easiest ways to look at it is nobody was happy with the Patriot Act, with the privacy violations that it brought, except we gave in because we said, this is for safety. We're in war. Right. And over the course of time, it was never reenacted or repealed. And another vote just came up and everybody's still pissed and they passed it anyway. According to most of America, most Americans, 70%, do not want multiple billions of dollars going over to the Ukraine or to Israel, to others, until we get our own shit together. And they did it anyway. And not only that, nothing went towards the border, right? Everybody knows that the border is very scary. I mean, I watched this boat go in Ensenada, or not Ensenada, but Carlsbad. I mean, just comes out and like 25 guys get up and just start running around. So, I mean, that is something that, you know, in terms of, you know, I don't even know where I'm going. But those are the things that I think of, right?
Did you vote this last November?
Oh, for the primary? No.
Yeah, or in any of the – do you vote on a yearly basis?
Yes, I vote. I've voted for Republican my whole life since 1988.
I probably vote 2 out of every 4 years. I try and get in the local stuff, but
yeah.
Here's the thing. I was watching this video. What brought this up is I was watching this video of this guy saying, does anybody really care? Like nobody's doing – it feels like nobody's doing anything about it, that everybody's – the rug is being pulled
out. Yes.
And everybody's just saying, oh, this is the way it is. Like
that's why the assimilation. This is why people like it doesn't matter. This is why I went back to the postmodern thing. Uh-huh. And going back to where I lost my train of thought. It's the idea that no matter where you go, what you do, or what you're looking at, it doesn't seem to make any sense. You know, even when you've got Mike Johnson, who at one point in time was basically like saying prayers and doing all this, and everybody's like, he's on board. And next thing you know, he's doing exactly what they all do. So, Jonathan, the thing about it is whether you're seeing the CIA literally guilty of killing a president or the FBI, you know, weaponizing, all these things are coming together where people feel powerless. And if what would happen if what they're doing in China happens to like a social credit score, right? What happens if, what's happening in other countries like Australia and in Canada, there's somebody's trying to whip out $1,000. They got $50,000 in their bank account. And the people are asking, why is this? Why are you doing this? What's the invoice? Show me what this is for. And it's like, I just want my money. It's my money. So right. Those are things that people are asking themselves, I'm powerless against this, right? So I think that's a reality, dude. I think it's a real
concern. Well, how do you respond to it? Because when we were interviewing Brian and I kind of said that, I thought, well, you know what? Actually, yeah. What would you do if nobody did anything about some major politician? I'm not picking either side out because they're both guilty.
I agree.
What would you do if nobody did anything about it? It's like, what could we do? It's like, do we just continue? Like, how much of it is a simulation meant just to fuck with you in the background going, yeah, this world is blowing up. How are you going to do tomorrow? You know,
I think you have to do these things like Brian was talking about. Right. I mean, he even went back like, hey, we're talking about it. Right. This is like it. The same analogy was, I don't know if it was Augustine or whatever. You know, he's throwing the starfish back into the ocean. There's thousands of them. There, a lot of them are going to die. And why are you doing it? Well, I saved that one. That one's going to thank me. Right. So yeah. The question is, what iterative processes can you do to try to make a difference? And maybe it starts, I don't know. It's not as simple as starting at the local government, your town or your county, and trying to make the community work, right? In terms of like, you know, ways that you can change, maybe what Brian was talking about, climate change, is you get small groups, you get together, you build bigger groups, you get some investors, and you start to make some noise, right? And so I really don't know how. I mean, it's like an open secret now. I mean, there's no community notes on Twitter anymore when, you know, Tucker says, you know, or and RFK Jr. says, yeah, the CIA killed my dad, right? That's it's not even showing up. Like community notes says, well, you might want to look at this, right? So I guess how would you make a difference? I mean, I think the small guys like saying, hey, I could vote for RFK Jr. I like him. I like his style. His family's been freaking screwed over. Let's go and see what happens, right? And maybe something miraculous will happen. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you like RFK?
I like him a lot. Yeah. He's definitely progressive on some issues, but I liked Andrew Yang.
Yeah, I did too.
I liked him a lot. Very winsome. He was on Fox. He knew why the truckers, you know, what they're going through. And the beauty of him is that he knew how to empathize. And that's what Vivek Ramaswamy is so good at. He can come across and he can even let somebody screaming at him in the audience come up and then totally talks, make sure he understands their point.
Right.
I think brings things down, lets them vent, right? And then comes back with something that seems always to be relatively like innocuous and like, oh my God, why didn't we all think of that, right? And so I think there's some magic and we need people like that in circles to grow and get bigger to make that. Cause I think he was an important voice, right? I think he's like kind of that person who's pulled behind and said, hey, because he just makes a lot of sense, right? He's just coming from the right. And I liked Andrew Yang the same way, articulate, winsome, not bagging on people, coming up with unique ideas, you know.
Did you like Pete Buttigieg?
No.
You didn't? Talk about
He was
he's the most articulate speaker of them all.
Oh, no, he knows how to dodge people. And when his infrastructure is fumbling and he says, why? Well, we can't be productive. He was the mayor of West Bend, Indiana. Mm-hmm. He has ideas that don't fall in line. An infrastructure plan that I think's not viable. And he comes in condescending. That's the problem. He comes in.
Oh, really? Is that what it feels like?
Oh, absolutely. No, he definitely comes in like, yeah, I'm going to take you down a little notch instead of like Vivek, who doesn't come like that. That's why I dislike Buttigieg.
Hey, why don't we finish with you brought in a white Negroni and you can share to our listeners how to make one.
Oh, sure.
I would love to, because you talked about this drink and I've had a Negroni. It's all right. But you talked about this one, a white Negroni. What's the difference?
Yeah. So a Negroni, for everybody's education, is a drink that came up from Florence, Italy, I think in the 30s. Basically, you've got Campari, which is the key component. It's a very bitter aperitif, and it's very dark red. And so it's very hot oftentimes in Italy. So you've got three components, Campari, sweet vermouth, and then you've got gin. So those are three main components of a Negroni. The beauty of a Negroni is when you take a look at it, you can literally intersperse every ingredient. And so much so that they call one, when you add rye to it or bourbon, it's called a Boulevardier. And of course, there's a variety of varieties, right? So what people started doing was like, well, if we can change the booze, why not, right? But let's try to make it a white Negroni. And I don't know where it came from, but you're just trying to mix up those flavor profiles. So white Negroni is traditionally gin as well. Mm-hmm. Instead of red Campari, you're using a derivative that's very bitter and herbaceous, but has a little bit more kick. It's more like a liqueur than the vermouth. So in this case, it was Luxardo's Bitter Bianco. So this is a... And by the way, instead of sweet vermouth, you're using dry vermouth. And then instead of gin, I actually used a G4 tequila. That's the new hottest tequila these days, G4 Blanco.
Why G4?
A fourth generation. That's what it stands for. When I was first introduced to it, it was a few months ago. And then all of a sudden, the bar that my son used to work for, they started carrying it. And then I saw an ad on Instagram that had it in there too, all at the same time. I'm like, okay, this is hopping. So let's go.
Nice.
Yeah, dude.
What do you garnish it with? So what's in the, in the white Negroni?
Oh yeah. Okay. 1 ounce of gin traditionally, 1 ounce of dry vermouth, and 1 ounce of either Sous, or you can use Luxardo Bitter Bianco. And instead of dry vermouth, you can also use Lillet Blanc. So I hope that helps. That's a white Negroni. And I garnished it with grapefruit. I garnished it with a grapefruit, but you could always use lemon or orange.
Okay. What is the difference between a dry and a sweet vermouth?
So a sweet vermouth is by default sweeter in taste. It's, imagine kind of a fortified wine with a lot of different herbs in there. It's not as bitter as Campari, but it does have an herbaceousness to it. Dry vermouth is just a hint of sweetness. It's also, I'd call it more citrusy and minerally, less fruity and herbaceousness. And it's really designed to accent the flavor of the gin. Whereas, like, if you think about a martini, most martinis are mostly gin or vodka and just a touch of dry vermouth, right? Whereas when you use red vermouth, it's traditionally as a complement, not an accent. It's literally like one equal part, or it's a solid part of that component. So in a Manhattan, you would have 2 ounces of bourbon, and you'd have like 1 ounce of vermouth. So that's almost half, right? So
yeah, I've never been a vermouth fan. I don't know why.
It takes some time. Yeah, I agree with that.
It's an acquired taste.
Well, that's the first part. The second part is what people don't know. And I said this on my story last weekend, is that it goes bad very quickly. Okay. So vermouth is only about 17 to 18% and it's not fortified, meaning like port has had brandy added to it to make it, let's say 20% or 30%.
Right.
And that's why port can sit in your cupboard for 2 years with a cork in it. Dry vermouth doesn't have that process added to it. So imagine opening up a 17% Zinfandel from Dry Creek and letting it sit in your cabinet for 3 or 4 weeks. That's not going to be a good Cabernet or a Zin, is it? So dry vermouth and sweet vermouth likely sat on a dry shelf, a warm shelf, and sat there for months, if not a year, when you were given it. So you might not have had the best vermouth ever.
Yeah. You know what I'm trying to think of? When I was in high school, we graduated and all went to Hawaii together, all my friends and all my friends that night, two of us went back and four of them went and got a martini and it had vermouth in it. And they all go, oh my God, we wanted to die. So from that point, I don't think I've ever had
interesting.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's the social dynamic of people creating tastes. You never tried it, but you know, it's awful, you know?
Yeah.
So
awesome.
So this has been a fun episode. I always love these topic ones, getting to discuss kind of what's on our heart. I know the world is interesting right now, and it'll be interesting to see where the rest of this year takes us. Any final thoughts?
Obviously the Holy Spirit just prompted and blew my shutters open. So no final thoughts, man. It's been a good episode, and I think that it was one where we kind of went introspective. It feels like rather than intellectualizing a conversation, this is, we were feeling it, man. You know, we literally were feeling, I think, a lot of the pain that's going on in the world. And it feels really real. And I'm looking forward to somehow getting a sign that the shit's going to break through before too long, you know?
I believe it will.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. If you're still around, please comment and review. Let us know if you'd like to see somebody. We'd be more than happy if you could introduce us. And we wish you all the best. Have a wonderful weekend to all of our listeners. Much love, everybody.